You're listening to By the Well, a lectionary-based podcast for preachers with Fran Barber and Robin Whittaker.
Hi folks, it's Fran here. This is the second week in the Easter season, so happy Easter to you all. We're going to be focusing on the Acts reading, Acts 4, 32 to 35, and the Gospel reading, John 20, verses 19 to 31.
And helping us today as our guest is the Reverend Dr. Kylie Crabb. She's familiar to many of you. Kylie is Director of Graduate Research Programs and a Senior Fellow, Research Fellow in Biblical and Early Christian Studies at the Australian Catholic University. She's also a Uniting Church minister. Kylie works on a range of things from feminist hermeneutics to disability studies and to Luke Acts and Second Temple Judaism. Her book published in 2019 is called Luke Acts and the End of History. So it will become apparent why we've asked Kylie to come help us out in this season where Acts is the first reading for Easter. So welcome, Kylie, and thank you for being here.
It's great to have you, Kylie.
Thanks. My pleasure. Great to join you.
Probably the first thing to say about Acts in the lectionary is that it's a bit all over the place and out of order.
You think?
I suppose our conversation today might focus particularly on the broad, the picture of Acts and what the author Luke is doing. So I wonder whether you could name some key features of the book of Acts, Kylie, that people should have at the forefront of their mind.
Yeah, great.
You're preaching from it.
Yeah, thanks, Fran. And I guess it is a funny invitation, actually, that we have throughout the Easter season to think about Acts instead of a Hebrew Bible reading. Mm. Fran, you're completely right that it's a bit all over the shop. So it's worth having in our heads kind of the bigger structure when we're looking at it, because you're going to find that if you go by the lectionary, you're jumping around quite a bit. I guess some of the key features.
Yeah.
Just thinking about the kind of like trajectory of the story of the narrative might be less familiar to us than the gospel reading trajectory is, but thinking, you know, it begins with the ascension, which is actually a bit of a repeat from, it's sort of like a in a television show when you have previously on
recap.
Luke's gospel. Yeah. Previously on Luke's gospel, we heard this.
Yeah.
And then we move into a retelling of the ascension narrative, which is a little bit different from the Luke version. So that's interesting in itself. And then we get a whole lot of different stories from in the Jerusalem church, including the Pentecost story, moving into chapters that deal with Peter's ministry in particular, with others from the Jerusalem church around him. The second kind of half of Acts tends to focus on Paul, and there are some bits in between where there's a bit of crossover. So you get Paul sort of introduced in at the beginning of chapter 8 when Stephen is martyred. And then chapter 9 has the Damascus Road experience that people might know about with Paul before returning in chapters 10 and 11 to the story of Cornelius with Peter. So we get this kind of little bit of crossover, but then it mostly moves into Paul in the second from that point onwards, which can be important to note. I should just say I just, you know, launched straight into that with about the ascension without pointing out the relationship between Acts and Luke, the Gospel of Luke, which is a bit of a funny relationship, actually. The general assumption for a long time has been that these are two volumes of the same work, both written by someone who the church has come to call Luke. And just recently there's been a bit more of a sort of breakdown of that consensus, partly because of noticing that there are a few differences between the volumes, but also because some people would like to suggest a sort of later date for Acts. Mm. And if you do that, it can't probably be written by the same historical person. But that is definitely not a done deal in the scholarship. Still, a lot of people want to point it out as being a two-part work. And I would say, like, at the very least, the person who wrote Acts intended it to be read as the sequel to Luke, because it's got a sort of introductory bit that holds them together. And then the jury might be out. We know that Acts was definitely written before 180 CE because it's cited by then. But actually a lot of people would say it's more like sort of the turn of the century that was written.
Yeah, maybe early second century. So makes it perhaps one of our later New Testament texts.
Definitely. Yep. And it is It's a bit of a funny tale. I don't know.
It's a rollicking read, I call it.
Yeah, I love that.
There's a lot of action, drama.
It would make a good movie.
Yep. So, like, if you've ever, like, just sat down and read it the whole way through, it's a bit of an interesting yarn. It's got some funny bits to it. Mm-hmm. And this raises a whole lot of questions about genre, which is what some Lucan scholars get totally hooked into, and you don't have to be completely interested in it. But to just think about one of the things that's been suggested is it reads like what we would think of as an ancient novel, which is a different thing to wonder about in terms of historicity, which we might come back to at some point and wonder about that. But it's certainly that it has these kind of features. The rollicking side, I think, of what Fran's talking about is this kind of part of the genre, and being able to have like sort of interesting characters and doing dynamic things and a lot of travel. And also in terms of the bits that people would identify as being like history, like an ancient kind of history, there's lots of speeches. And that is something that we see all the time in other Greek historiography, that there's a lot of imagining what the character would say and then writing out a kind of direct speech that tells us something about what's going on in the narrative.
So it's like adding dialogue like you would in a contemporary novel a bit. You've imagined some dialogue.
Yeah, and even exactly. And even ancient historians would say that they know it's not like a Hansard version is of Parliament.
Yeah.
They know that it is you imagine yourself into the space of that character and then you write the kind of thing they would have said. And it's normally really rhetorically perfect and that kind of thing.
Polished.
Polished.
Can I make a comment about the unity of the two books, like the questions around the authorship, but that we receive it in the way that we have it and that it starts in Jerusalem at the beginning of Acts and ends in Rome. It starts in Jerusalem at the beginning of Luke.
Yes.
And then ends in Rome.
Yes.
At the end of Acts, so it's gone the farthest reaches of the world in some sense. So theologically, the gospel has reached the universal.
But then there's a question, right? Totally, and heaps of people will observe that kind of movement, especially because we get something in Acts 1 that talks about the worldwide mission kind of thing, that you'll go to the farthest reaches of the earth. Mm. But there's also this kind of empire kind of tension in that about is Rome the kind of end point of the gospel in any kind of imperial kind of sense? And, you know, we might notice things like the end of Acts, which is a bit enigmatic, frankly. Mm. It's kind of strange. Yeah, and it's funny. It ends with a conflict between Paul and some Jewish believers in Rome, some of whom believe what Paul is saying about Jesus and some don't, so they're divided. But it doesn't end, oddly, perhaps, with Paul before Caesar, which is what he said earlier in Acts. He's had a vision that needs to take place. So there's something maybe sort of subversive in there about, like, that even if it's travelled this whole way and we've got, like, Jewish identity and Roman identity and, of course, those things together in the person of Paul, who's famously both, but that it doesn't end with the emperor. Mm. And that could be important too. It could be that people go to the furthest reaches elsewhere.
Can I ask quickly about theological emphases? We get the Spirit seems very active in Acts, as sort of in Luke. And obviously we get Gentile inclusion. There's lots of visions. People are having visionary kind of experiences, apocalyptic experiences.
Yep.
What would you sort of emphasize theologically in terms of?
Yeah. That they're all great things. All the things you guys are both mentioning are great. I guess one of the things, and it will come up like this. I mean, this actually prompted me to think about why is Acts the kind of extra reading through the lectionary during this time, because in fact the resurrection is the primary theme of the speeches in Acts, and both the sort of like directly related speeches and even when it's said in passing by the narration that there's been some kind of teaching or preaching or whatever it's about, the content is the resurrection. So
That's really, I mean, that might seem obvious, but that's really important.
Yeah, it's really important. I think I've gone through before and worked out that there are 10 speeches where the primary content is resurrection. And then there are further kind of like many, but like at least that I can think off the top of my head, like four other passages where you're told by the narration that this is the content of the preaching. And interestingly, there are also seven circumstances in which the preaching of the disciples of the apostles leads into a conversation about repentance and the need for repentance. So I'd say that that is a key theme, and it fits with a very controversial part of Lucan studies, which is eschatology. And so how this fits with the claims that Luke and Acts are making about the culmination of all things, what it is that Jesus has inaugurated and what is still being waited on. And that this is a crucial part of this these books in the New Testament.
And we might return to that, but I want to get us into our passage for today, which starts sort of like the last bit of chapter 4. And takes us into perhaps one manifestation of what you're talking about, Kylie, because we do get lots of insights into these new Christian communities, these newly gathered communities that behave in certain ways.
Yep.
And this one is a vision of a community that share all possessions, everything's held in common, the kind of vision of a Christian community we might say the monastic tradition, amongst others, is based on. Can you take us into this passage in terms of what we should be attentive to?
Yes, absolutely. Well, and I'm keen to hear what all of us think we should be attentive to in this passage, because it will be probably familiar to people, and it's and it's also kind of like a confronting passage in a way, right? So one of the things I want to point out is that this is like a little it's called like a summary narration. So it's like pulling together a whole lot of themes from things that have just been happening.
Yep.
And we get another one of those in chapter 2 from verse 42. Which comes after, like after the Pentecost story and stuff. So a little summary that. So this is kind of bookending some stuff as well with these kind of summaries, and it's interesting that, of course, resurrection is in there as well, but that it's like the begins and ends with stuff about sharing possessions, sharing resources, and that no one is in any need. One of the things, and this is really not to undermine the importance of the message of these verses, but I do think it prompts us into another conversation about how we preach on it, is to point out that, of course, just a couple of chapters later, at the beginning of chapter 6, we get this thing where the Greeks are coming and saying and complaining that their widows, the Greek widows, are not being given their own share of the resources in redistribution, and so this is what prompts, of course, the beginning of the diaconate in order to ensure that that happens. But so, how are we meant to kind of make sense of this? Is there, are these idealized verses? Are they trying to set up that this? I would try and really avoid this reading, but the idea that things are perfect and then they kind of fall apart. Seems to me that there's something else going on about the aspiration that is identified in here. And I wondered if you guys had thoughts on that.
Well, my first thought is that we can, what rich people, get a bit scholarly about these things and absolve ourselves of responsibility for taking them seriously.
Yes, so, exactly.
Because we really don't want to sell everything we own.
No, so I'd be hesitant to go that direction.
Yep, yep.
But I think it does raise the question whether this is normative, like whether this few verses, the vision of this particular Christian community, which we get within Acts, is clearly not perfect if the distribution isn't perfect.
Is
this what we are to all aspire to, or I don't, it's hard, right? I think that's actually difficult, and we need to be quite cautious about how we preach these things.
Yeah.
I mean, We can talk about the values here, right? That no one's in need.
Yep.
And what does it mean to have a community where no one's in need? Clearly, our entire world, it fails that measure.
Yeah. Well, I was reading a commentary in the Bratslav series, and the author's name was Jaroslav, I think, and he was reading this, interpreting this passage. He talked about how we interpret our biblically what using our creeds, and he could see the one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church expressed in this reading, and the holiness was in the divestment of goods amongst one another, and the emphasis on the whole group, the universe, the unity here as well. So that was one way. Into the passage that he went.
Yeah. So actually is a vision for the church family, kind of universal.
And that it was that what we confess about the church is in this passage.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that struck me in verse 33, because I think because it is so confronting and challenging to us, we all notice the sharing of possessions and the giving up what you own. But right in the middle of that is with great power the apostles gave their testimony to the resurrection.
Yeah.
So there's our resurrection emphasis. And grace, great grace was upon them all. So there's, you know, I think sometimes for churches that are very social justice minded, we can preach the care for the needy, give up your possessions vision, and we've divorced it from theology.
Yeah.
And here it is deeply tied to, you know, the ability to have a gracious and profoundly radical disruptive of the local economy response precisely because of the testimony about the resurrection.
Yeah, yeah.
So at the very least, we've got to tie those things together.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, it's interesting to sort of contextualize this within Second Temple Judaism and say this is not the first community of people who are sharing their resources through faith commitments, right? So we've got documents in found at the Dead Sea and stuff that show a kind of like a community rules about how to share with the most vulnerable in your community, lists the kinds of categories of people who would need financial support and how people are meant to go about doing that. So it is actually a shared tradition across Judaism and Christianity to be doing these things. And in fact, one thing I would also point to that people might know, John Barclay, a New Testament scholar who has written many, many things about this kind of time, but one of his current projects is having talked about Paul and the gift, where he was talking about the divine gift and grace, different ways of understanding grace. He's now doing a lot of fantastic research into the relationships between Christians that have the understanding of care for the poor and saying that we have a lot of stuff. So, for instance, in Acts scholarship, there's often been a bit of talk about like, well, this must be all wealthy Christians who have all this stuff to share. Mm-hmm. And so it's about a kind of one-way thing. It's like charity. We're kind of establishing a kind of charity here. And John would say, actually, one of the ways that early Christian communities survived is that they share their resources amongst the poor, you know, so that you've got you actually need these relationships of reciprocity in order to survive when there's a bad season with crop growing or whatnot. Anyway, so that is part of it.
I think it'd be good, props, and correct me if I'm wrong, Kylie, but that we shouldn't minimise the radicality of that sharing, indeed amongst faith communities of Jewish and Christian identity, but the radicality of that against Rome and against the pagan, for want of a better word, culture around it, which, you know, if you didn't have a family and you didn't have those sort of familial contacts, you were on your own, so that this is really quite radical stuff in that context.
Yeah. Well, and actually the other way in which Christianity is radical in this time, of course, is that it is causing division among family. So the kind of safety net you used to have, which is that your extended family will get you out. Actually, people are making radical choices with their faith and life commitments that means that they then have to have that kind of kinship. That stuff when you read early Christian documents where they're talking about one another as being like brother and sister. This is actually really, it's not just like
friendly.
Friendly, it's not like all fluffy
talk. No, it's like family responsibility for them.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. So it's really.
And I mean, again, in the West, we're often protected from this, but I've certainly met particularly some students from Asian origin that when they converted to Christianity, I mean, their families, you know, semi-disowned them, or certainly it made the family relationship incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
And that would be true in many other cultures around the world too, where Christianity is not the dominant religion. And so if you don't have that support system in every meaning of it, not just financial, so I think we're pointing to a fuller sense here, but not to skip over the financial economic implications of this as well. Yep. We need to move on to John, but Kylie's going to stick around and talk about John 20 with us too.
Did you know we have a Facebook group? You can find a link at our website, fatherwell.com.au.
So some of you might have preached on the first part of John 20 on Easter Sunday, but we pick up the story here in verse 19. And John, I mean, in a sense, this is a big passage and you might want to pick which bit to focus on, because I think there's at least two sermons or two potential foci here. The first few verses really are about Jesus, the first appearance to disciples in behind locked doors. There's fear that moves very quickly to joy. There's the giving of peace, but ultimately it's a commissioning story. We can come back to some of those themes, the giving of the Spirit. So we're seeing the Spirit everywhere in the readings already as we start to head from Easter to Pentecost. And then the second half is this famous story about the faith of Thomas, who I refuse to call Doubting Thomas because he is actually, we're going to see, makes a profound declaration of faith. But absolutely. It's a week later, but kind of these two appearances of Jesus in the midst. So take us into the text. What did either of you notice about this text? What's worth drawing out?
That the doors were locked for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And that the first greeting was peace be with you.
Yeah.
So I'm struck by the sense of, I don't know, of hiding and fear.
Yes.
And
it's dark, it's evening.
And it's evening, yep.
Yep.
And Jesus came, and, like the doors were locked, but Jesus came and stood among them. There's no, he'd bash down the door or, you know.
Just knock, appears.
You know, or.
So just a casual pop-in by Jesus.
You know, so this is one of the appearances.
Yeah.
You know,
One of many resurrection appearances we get. Well, we get at least, I think, three or so at the end of John here, but other Gospels will all have their own iterations.
The thing that always strikes me is that is the sort of two parts to this reading I think it also really strikes me because of course you have this in Easter too. It's the reading every year in the lectionary.
Yeah.
And you have this sense of like, as a preacher, you think, how am I going to preach on Easter every weekend? Of course you do that all the time anyway, but you know what I mean? Yeah. That we're going to retell this story every week. And then you get this reading where there are 2 weeks already in the reading where the church is back again. You know, like they have this profound experience with this peace be with you, all this stuff, they've given the Spirit, blah, blah. Yep. And then they're back there the next week, also locked away. It sort of makes me want to know, like, you know, well, I mean, I guess what happens the week after that? You know,
are they back again? Feel able to leave?
At what point do they go out and actually do something?
That's right. Well, I mean, at some point they're out fishing, but
that's,
you know.
That's one of the preaching themes you could do. Is our church behind locked doors still? What sort of locked doors are we behind?
Yes.
Well, and maybe problematizing locked door. You know, we've been in lockdown, which has been such a time of grief and difficulty for so many people through for good reasons, right? Mm. And then so what does it mean to be out in the community even when we have to be in lockdown in different ways and, you know, like all that sort of stuff?
Or what does it mean that, I mean, I'm conscious for listeners around the world who are still in lockdown and won't have Easter, be celebrating Easter in churches like we have been able to this Easter. We didn't last Easter in Australia, or at least in parts of Australia. But what does it mean that Jesus appears in the middle of the locked doors and in the middle of the darkness and fear? Like Jesus is right there in the midst of that.
Yep.
And then turns it into joy with this greeting of peace and his very presence. You know, we get told that the disciples were glad seeing the Lord. So their experience of Jesus brings this Cairo, this joy.
Yeah, I think it's really profound when Thomas is, you know, Jesus appears to Thomas with that great peace. So, you know, Jesus, we recognize Jesus in the moment of peace.
Yeah.
But also in the violence of the hands and the wounds. Yeah. That's where he recognizes Jesus as well.
I mean, I don't know, Kylie, what you think from a sort of a disability studies point of view. I've always found it so profoundly striking that Jesus in this resurrection appearance bears all the marks of the violence done to him. So there's something about a resurrected body. I think we can have a naive idea that we're all somehow perfected.
Yes.
Or what does, and it challenges that very notion of what perfection means. That Jesus still has these marks of violence. They're healed, but they're there.
Yeah, that's
they're touchable.
Right. There's, and exactly, and there is actually like a whole conversation there about in terms of this story and also kind of riffing off martyrdom stories about whether people have the signs of their martyrdom still in the resurrection. And if people wanted to read more about that, there's a great book by Candida Moss called Divine Bodies, Resurrecting Perfection. And it's interesting from the perspective of like martyrdom stuff, but where it really hits the road is exactly the kind of place you're talking about, Robin, in terms of what is the nature of the perfect body and how do we expect change amongst people with various impairments or even, you know, in those who don't identify as having particular impairments, what is the transformation we anticipate in our lives now as well as in a kind of post-mortem existence?
Yeah, so what challenges notions of what healing can look like.
Yes, and, absolutely.
Yeah, all of that. And so there's something also profound there for me theologically that Jesus is recognized in his wounds.
Yeah.
I want to circle back to the spirit though, because in many ways, I mean, I've certainly sat in church service after church service that makes us all about Thomas.
Yes.
You know, and really the main characters are the spirit and Jesus. And I think the spirit in John, so in the first part of this reading where Jesus literally gives them the spirits, he says, receive the spirit. I mean, we've got to remember in John, back in chapter 1, the spirit descends on Jesus and John the Baptist testifies to that. He doesn't baptize him, he testifies to seeing the spirit come upon Jesus. So Jesus' entire ministry is marked by being the one upon, you know, who has received the spirit. His whole conversation with Nicodemus in chapter 3 is about you can't be born anew unless you're born of spirit.
Yep.
You know, Jesus will teach about the Spirit. He will promise the giving of the Advocate Spirit. And ultimately, in his death at the end of chapter 19, he gives up his Spirit, is a particular Johannine utterance on the cross. And now that Spirit is being given to the disciples as promised earlier in the Gospel. And with it, the commissioning that as my Father sent me, I send you. So this is a very strong, like, what's the impact of the resurrection? A bit like Acts connection here. It's that you now continue the ministry of Jesus.
Mm. Which I think, maybe I'm switching it from the spirit again, which is maybe not what you want to. But I think that what you're talking about there about this handing over of responsibility of this kind of new life and new way of being in life really draws attention to one of the other sort of features of the story, which is that it's leading towards these statements about blessed are those who believe without seeing. And of course it's a direct address to the reader who has had this profound experience of having read John's gospel and seen these things unfold, but hasn't been a witness in person. And so can see the profound statement of faith we get from Thomas that my Lord and my God, and also see the blessing upon him as being, you know, how much more blessed is me as a reader who knows this. And continues to live in the spirit, really, having been born again.
We shouldn't skip over that. I mean, Thomas is the only one in the gospel to call Jesus my God.
Mm. Yeah.
And if you think about someone who's grown up, you know, through the Jewish tradition of monotheism, to declare Jesus God is about the most profound confession of faith in this gospel. I don't know. A Johannine scholar might challenge that, but whatever.
It's confession after the wounds, the encounter with the wounds.
And that's what, the comfort I find in this, and it perhaps creates a nice pairing to the Acts reading, which can feel like, oh, here's some perfect Christians who got it all right.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, as we said before, these disciples are behind locked doors. They're fearful. They haven't quite got what any of this is about yet. Thomas is questioning and wanting signs, which is a big theme in John. And yet it is those people that Jesus commissions to carry on his work. So there's something about the imperfect and fragile nature of their faith is not an obstacle to their commissioning and calling. And I think that's a nice word for our people.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. And that is in the level of the narrative here, that's also symbolized in the fact that those locked doors, Jesus just goes, like, there's no barrier. Yeah. They do nothing.
Yeah. Yes, Jesus comes to them.
Invite Jesus in.
Yeah. It's quite encouraging, really.
Again, it's countering that narrative where we're, you know, popularly we've you found God, you know.
Yes, no.
But actually it's the other way around and God will find you even behind locked doors.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Even in the body of a crucified person.
And the last thing I want to say about this and is I'm conscious that this stuff about forgiveness of sins has been interpreted in some traditions as a very priestly or ecclesial calling, that this is a commissioning to a select few. Mm. But the language here is of disciples, and disciples are distinct in the text from the 12, so it's a larger group. Want to think it included women, but it's not explicit, but we could...
Well, it
doesn't say they weren't there, so let's just pretend. But all that is to say, this is the commissioning of a community. And again, I think that's important for, like, you know, that this call of God and the giving of the Spirit is given to every believer.
And not on their own.
Not on their own, yep.
No.
Yep.
But, and also I find that also that there's a challenge in that is that, you know, if we're not about embodying this reconciliation, then it's not – then forgiveness is withheld. You know, like this is that actually we have a not just an invitation to be able to exercise this, but an imperative to, because actually this is – the world needs this kind of reconciliation. We need to be involved in it.
Yeah, and it has been done for us.
Yes.
So we're living out a response to reality.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Kylie Crabb, for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Introducing us to ACTS. We'll look forward to hearing more from you in the weeks ahead.
Thank you both.
By the Well is brought to you by Pilgrim Theological College, the Uniting Church in Australia, and produced by Adrian Jackson.